Mm-hmm. I mean, in Texas, maybe they do, but, you know, I can't see why aliens would give us advanced technology. Remember, this is the planet on which between 50 and 60 million people were killed during World War II. We destroyed 1,700 cities. These are guys you're going to give advanced technology to? You got to be nuts.
Well, I understand it. They're making a sweat for this technology. A buddy of mine who was in the Canadian military, you know, verified in personal conversations that there were retrievals at Roswell and that they are working very, very hard to try to, you know, retrofit all this science into our world, and that's where we acquire things like stealth technology or advanced fighter planes or any type of modern technology they've recovered from there. Of course, you're not allowed to talk about that in any way, shape, or form. And he was roundly, not exactly punished, but set up for the kill for even revealing some of this information, where, you know, he was left in a very precarious position where he could be destroyed at a moment's notice, have his reputation destroyed, and, you know, any potential employment prospects. So then he just, you know, kept very silent after that. But it's just inconceivable that an event like that couldn't be accepted in, on a broader forum. And anyone who does any reading about what you've described at all these labs, like the Skunk Works and their equivalents, they're so far ahead of, you know, where most people think they are. It's like wherever you graduated from school, it's like you stop learning. So if you graduate in 1965, you have to stay in 1965, and you never go any further because I guess there's no one to look at their tests and cheat on their notes or something like that anymore. And people just stop thinking. And well, I'm amazed at that.
You can understand that governments don't want to release data. And people say, well, why? Are they afraid of panic? I don't think that's the problem. I give six reasons why all governments, not just the U.S., which is spending roughly $630 billion this year on things military. That's a lot of dough. Six reasons. One, you want to figure out how the darn things work. You set up your secret project. Rule number one for security is you cannot tell your friends without telling your enemies. They listen to the radio too, guys. Second problem is the other side of the coin. What if somebody else figures out how they work before you do? You don't want them to know. You know they know. The third problem is, what if an announcement were made tomorrow by two highly trusted people around the world, a little hard to find. My favorite odd couple, the Queen and the Pope. They're about the same age. You know, what if they said, look, the planet is being visited, but it's okay. What would happen? Well, church attendance would go up, mental hospital admissions would go up, the stock market would go down. But I think one of the things that would happen, based on 600 college lectures, is that the younger generation, which, unlike me, was never alive when there wasn't a space program, would push for a new view of ourselves instead of as Canadians, Americans, Greeks, Peruvians, Spanish, whatever, as Earthling. I mean, it's pretty obvious from an alien view. Well, we are all Earthlings. We don't like it very much. I mean, some people in Quebec don't like that attitude either, for that matter. So I can understand that. And then there's a fourth problem. Jerry Falwell, the late Jerry Falwell, and Pat Robertson have both said, we are the only intelligent life in the universe. All this UFO stuff is demons. Demons. And, you know, they'd be up the creek without a paddle if an announcement were to be made. Fifth problem, people say to me, well, Stan, if they're coming here and we're not going there, that means they're more advanced than we are. Yea, verily, we haven't been around that long. Unless you believe Bishop Usher that it was all created 4004 B.C. I think it was Thursday, October 27th. I'm not sure about that. I wasn't there. unless you believe that, then these guys, the aliens would be more advanced than we are. And some people say that means that soon there'd be new methods of energy production. Yay, verily, let's get it. New methods of ground transport, air transport, computers, communications, economic chaos. Well, that's the way life goes. Not many people making buggy whips anymore. And finally, sixth, in the course of all my lecturing, I have heard seven different stories of Earthlings going up, airplanes, going up to shoot down UFOs. Orders were given to do that in the U.S. in 1952, incidentally. There's a fine book, Shoot Them Down, by Frank Fascino. It's listed on my website, as all the other stuff is, www.stanfriedman.com. Anyway, I've heard seven different stories of guys going up and never coming back. Obviously, I didn't hear it from them. I heard it from, you know, the mechanics, the other pilots, whatever. And none of the families were told what happened to their family member. Unfortunate accident, plane lost at sea. Sorry about that, folks. So no government would want to admit that that's happened. So none of that has anything to do with the fear of panic or anything like that. And one of the silliest books is the one about Area 51 by Annie Jacobson. And she explains that the Russians were trying to produce panic like the War of the Worlds did by having Dr. Death, Dr. Mengele, Joseph Mengele, working for Joe Stalin, creating strange bodies of beings. And it was crashed out there, and it was supposed to produce a panic. Now, if you can make sense out of that, you're a better man than I am, Gunga Dean.
Stanton, there's a lot of, you've been in the talking a little bit about military contracts. There's a lot of speculation that DARPA has used alien technology to be way ahead of its time, not only in weaponry, but in technology as well.
Well, it wouldn't surprise me, but I think what people don't give enough credit to is the fact that in the Cold War, if you will, there was an enormous amount of money spent on developing new technology. The academics don't seem to understand it. You know, a big project is four professors and 20 grad students. As I mentioned, we employed 3,500 people at GEAP way back in 1958. You put enough money after it, and any idea that you could try put together that'll put us ahead of the Russians would get money. Some of them were pretty stupid, but a lot of work came out of that. The amount of technical work that was done under government contract in industry, not in academia, was enormous. So I don't want to give the aliens all the credit. Now, admittedly, the thing that makes a project most likely to be successful is knowing what you're trying to do can be done. Hitler didn't know you could build an atomic bomb. He spent a little money, but he spent his money on rockets. He knew you could build them. The Russians, after the war, we'd already set off five bombs. They knew you could build an atomic bomb. They were as smart as we were. They had the biggest cyclotron in Europe before the war. They had their hands full with a little war in their backyard, which we didn't have to worry about. And the most shocking document I ever saw, I think, from the National Security Council, 1951, it was declassified. The statement was made that the Russians had made more progress in the last 18 months on the development of nuclear weapons and methods for delivering them that had been expected for 5 years. The people in Washington were very worried. We didn't think they could deliver a bomb. It turns out we'd left the B-29, and they copied it and improved it, and they had their delivery system as well. And we were scared. So anything that would give us a hope was funded. Huge budgets for all kinds of stuff, some of which was junk, but some of which was worthwhile. So I don't give the aliens all that credit. I mean, if you had given Christopher Columbus a nuclear submarine in 1493 and say, hey, great work, Chris. I got a nuclear submarine here and an unlimited budget. I need two more of these. You think you could build them for me? No way in the world he could have. He was too far behind. So the fact that we have recovered a saucer doesn't mean we know how to duplicate it.
Good.
That's good.
Well, you were one of the first people, or probably, to really get into Roswell, and you did interview Major Marcel.
I was the first to interview Major Marcel.
What were some of the stories or reports that you received from contact with him to, give us a good description of the incident at Roswell from his perspective?
Well, it was funny how I found out about it. I was at a television station in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. I was supposed to be interviewed three times, three different people, to help promote my lecture that night at Louisiana State University. And I did the first two interviews, and the third reporter was nowhere to be found. This is before everybody had a cell phone. And the station manager's giving me coffee. He's looking at his watch. He's embarrassed. He knew the people who brought me to the station, and he knew I had other things to do. And out of the blue, he says, the guy you ought to talk to is Jesse Marcel. Being the brilliant investigator I am, I said, who's he? His next statement changed my life. He handled wreckage on one of those saucers you're interested in when he was in the military. What? Totally unexpected, as you can imagine. And so I said, what do you know about him? He lives over in Houma. That didn't tell me much because I didn't know where Houma was. I've been there since. He's a good guy. We're old ham radio guys. You ought to talk to him. Then the reporter showed up, busy the rest of the day. The next day I was at the airport early. I called information, got a number for Jesse, used the name Bill Allen of the television station guy. It turned out, I found out later, Jesse hadn't told him anything. He'd seen the article in the paper. Jesse's picture was all over the place. His name was all over the place. And on July 6th, 1947, a rancher, Mac Brazel, came into town, talked to the sheriff. It was a Sunday. This is 2 weeks after the big noise about flying saucers began. Kenneth Arnold's famous sighting, June 24th. And the rancher, Mac Brazel, had found this strange wreckage on his ranch. His sheep wouldn't cross the debris field, a huge amount of stuff. Crazy. It was very lightweight, shiny metal like foil, but couldn't break it. You could bend it, but you couldn't cut it. Weird stuff. And he was at the general store in little town of Corona on the 5th of July. He didn't have a radio, didn't have a telephone. He brought some of this wreckage in, and have people saying, maybe that's part of one of those flying saucers. They're offering a reward for it. What? Yeah, you ought to go into the sheriff in Roswell, bigger town than the local sheriff. And that's where the base was, the big military base. That's where I'll be next weekend. And so on Sunday, the 6th, he takes some of the wreckage to the sheriff's office. The sheriff, by prearrangement, called the base. Now, you have to understand, this wasn't just a bunch of GIs with nothing to do. It was the most elite military group in the entire world. They had dropped the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. They dropped two more in Operation Crossroads in 1946 in the Pacific. So they were the first line of defense. They had nuclear weapons. Nobody else did. And the sheriff calls the base, talks to Jesse Marcel. He talks to his boss, goes to town and checks out what the sheriff had there. Talks to his boss. The boss says, take one of our counterintelligence corps guys with you and go out and see what's out there, because the rancher had stressed there's an enormous amount of this stuff out there. And so they did that. Back roads. The site, the crash site, is off the road. 75 miles from town, but several miles from a road. They saw all this stuff out there, and Jesse said in our first conversation, there wasn't anything conventional out there. He'd served in the Pacific, of course. He'd seen airplane crashes. You find wires, vacuum tubes, labels that say made in Oshkosh or whatever. Wasn't anything conventional out there, and he figured it had to be an above-ground blast explosion. because it was spread out over such a large area, three quarters of a mile long, a few hundred yards wide, and because there was no crater. Normally when an airplane goes in, boy, you're going to see a big hole in the ground. And there wasn't any. So they bring it back to town. He stops at his house that night, shows his 11-year-old son, who is still alive, is a medical doctor, served as a colonel in the military, flight surgeon, helicopter pilot, and he served later on a military aircraft accident investigative team. Never saw anything like this stuff. Goes into the base, Jesse does, the next morning, and the base commander gives two important orders. One was to the press guy, Lieutenant Walter Howe, put out a press release saying, we've captured one of these flying saucers that people have been seeing. And the second order is to Jesse, take some of this wreckage with you on one of our B-29s to our headquarters in Fort Worth, Texas, and then on to Wright Field. Wright Field, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio now, is where all captured enemy equipment went. Standard place where they try to back engineer. And, of course, everybody follows orders. When Jesse gets to Fort Worth, General Ramey says, you don't say anything. I'll take care of it. He was head of the 8th Air Force, and Jesse's boss, Colonel Blanchard, reported to Ramey. And I found out many years later, I found Ramey's chief of staff. He took the call from Ramey's boss in Washington, giving him three orders. Send some of that wreckage up here today with one of your colonel couriers. Get the press off our backs. I don't care how you do it. And I don't want you ever to talk about it again, not even your buddy Roger Ramey. That's an order. Do I need to put it in writing, Colonel? No, sir. They knew each other. That was a two-star general, incidentally, McMillan. And so, within hours, the second press release went out. Sorry we made a mistake. It was just a radar reflector weather balloon combination. Nothing to worry about. And by the next day, Ramey empties Roswell's saucer, and that was the end of that. Until I got involved. Then they came up with other explanations. A mogul balloon train. Super secret, except it wasn't. And in no way you could confuse that with any kind of a vehicle of any sort. 20 to 24 conventional standard weather balloons that you could buy in a surplus store for many years. And the dates weren't right. The wreckage wasn't right. I mean, everything was wrong. But then my favorite explanation, the stories about bodies, the Air Force said, oh, we figured that one out. We did a lot of checking. It turns out that all over New Mexico, we were dropping crash test dummies. So their first big fat volume was Roswell Report, Truth versus Fiction in the New Mexico Desert. They supplied the fiction. And then, case closed. That was the title of the next report. The talk about bodies was because people were finding these crash test dummies. Now, that sounds very good, except I found the guy who was in charge of the program, his picture's in the report, talked to them in person, Colonel Madsen, and there were two problems, at least. None of the dummies were dropped until 1953, so we have time travel, six-year time travel for crash test dummies. And for the test to be meaningful, the dummies were 6 feet tall, 175 pounds, and they were in Air Force uniforms, because if a pilot is going to get out of an airplane at high altitude, he's going to be in uniform, and it affects the drag, you know, when you're falling and when you open your parachute, the temperature. If you're real high, you don't want to freeze to death before you get to the ground, et cetera, et cetera. So the New York Times didn't talk to Colonel Madsen. They bought it. Upper left, front page, Sunday New York Times, crash test dummy story. Were they dummies? So I get a little perturbed at some of the people who try to attack Roswell and don't do their homework. including the New York Times, to say the least. So it's been an ongoing story. I'll be there, as I say, in a week. There'll be a bunch of papers by professionals like myself. In the 50th anniversary, I don't know how many thousands of people were there for the conference. And you have to understand, Roswell isn't on the way to anywhere. It's 200 miles from Albuquerque, 200 miles from Amarillo, 200 miles from El Paso. If you're there, it's because you want to be there. And there will be lots of people there. You probably need to go 50 miles to get another motel out of town, frankly.
Yes, an alien wouldn't want to be caught dead there.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. It gets pretty hot. Hotter than in Toronto, but no humidity.
Well, one of the big, clues or pieces of evidence that one would have when dealing with the fact that the government's trying to say you have a crash test dummy and someone else is beside some dead thing would be, there's no mistake, because the flesh of even an extraterrestrial baking in the hot sun down there should have a very distinct odor compared to any crash test dummy that would be sitting around for some period of time and would be very, very glaringly obvious to any observer that they're dealing with something that was alive.
And 4 or 5 feet tall with a big head, incidentally, and no uniform.
So, but of course they do lie. There were two crash sites, too, as I understand it.
Well, yes, at that time, there was another crash in the plains of San Agustin, which is about 100 miles west of the Corona site, if you will. And a new book has just come out. I'll have a few copies with me Saturday night.
Hi, this is Jay at the Power Mall. I thought I would discuss an item that's very valuable to my personal health and well-being. That product is called Curcumin X4000. Its potent antioxidant properties have been shown to decrease swelling and allow us to enjoy our golden years. Take control over your health today, guys. Order Curcumin by calling 877-817-9829 or order at thepowermall.com. That's thepowermall.com.
Oxygen. It's nature's oldest therapy and plays an essential role in destroying viruses, bacteria, mold, yeast, and fungus, and keeping the human body healthy and strong. Now, you can give your body and your immune system a mega boost of disease-fighting oxygen with all-natural Oxy-C. With so many people now leading a sedentary indoor lifestyle, most are in a chronic state of oxygen deprivation, which sets up a perfect environment for disease, general fatigue, and a host of other symptoms. Oxy-C is yours in simple, convenient capsules. Nothing to mix, nothing to hassle with. Take it with juice or water anytime. Feel a cold or flu approaching? Have no energy or spark anymore? Try all-natural Oxy-C and prepare to be amazed. Oxy-C is only available from New Earth Health Solutions at Rents.com. Look for the New Earth banner at Rents.com.
We've all heard about antibiotics, but what about probiotics? Antibiotic means against life. Probiotic means pro-life. Antibiotics kill bacteria that are infectious and harmful to the body. They also kill the good bacteria, though, that are necessary for good health. Probiotics from Living Streams replaces the healthy balance of friendly bacteria and normalizes the digestive tract. Gastritis, ulcers, diarrheal disease is just a few of the problems people develop when the intestinal flora is out of balance. Living Streams probiotics create the healthy balance needed for good digestion, suppresses growth of pathogenic bacteria, and actually increases resistance to infection. Call the Power Hour, 877-817-9829. Order your Living Stream probiotics today. They're available in 2, 4, and 8-ounce bottles, and Living Streams probiotics comes with a money-back guarantee. Get your body back in balance with Living Streams probiotics today. 877-817-9829. That's 877-817-9829. Living Streams probiotics. Everyone should be pro-life.
If you've been listening to this program for any length of time, you'll know that Fukushima, the greatest calamity in history, has now, as I've been warning since 3/11, killed off virtually the whole North Pacific Ocean and especially up and down the entire West Coast. The radiation is migrating inland and is moving across the entire country. There's only one proven defender to radiation exposure, the brilliant Chernobyl-proven discovery of Dr. Michael Kiriak, which combines the four most potent and powerful algaes on the planet, imported to the U.S. and known as Bio's Superfood. I've taken Bio's Superfood every day for several years now and want you to do the same for your sake and the health and safety of your family and loved ones. Take the banner at the top of Rents.com and prepare to learn how to save your life.
Hi, this is Catherine at the Power Hour. The Power Mall began when Joyce Riley discovered an all-natural soap that heals skin issues and can replace your bathing, laundry, and household cleaning products. That soap is Miracle 2 and is made from natural minerals and coconut extract with no added fragrances or colors and is naturally concentrated and biodegradable. I guarantee after you discover how amazing Miracle 2 products are, you'll recommend them to everyone you know. To order, call 877-817-9829 or visit thepowermall.com today. You'll learn why so many people say, it's not just soap, it's a miracle.
With dozens of food storage companies buying up airtime all over radio, it's hard for you to know which company you can actually trust. Numana Food Storage is nutritious, is GMO-free, contains no aspartame, no high fructose corn syrup, has no chemicals, preservatives, or soy. And Numana Food Storage has a 25-year shelf life. Call Jay at 877-817-9829. That's 877-817-9829. Or order online at thepowermall.com.
America made just for you. Food storage, I love to eat. Yum!
March 1948, Aztec is in the Four Corners area of New Mexico, northwestern corner, and Scott and Suzanne Ramsey have done a bang-up job of investigating. This just came out last month. I wrote the foreword for the book because I really appreciate how much work they did and how thorough an investigation they did. And they talked to people who helped clean up the site, who made sure that you could get it from there to Los Alamos, despite bridges and, you know, other blockages on the way. And so, you know, we're going to be hearing more, I think, as the word gets out. And, you know, maybe in the next 10 years, the government is going to open up a little bit, being an optimist.
Now, Stanton, what about, when we get back to Roswell, what about all this alien autopsies and the footage and all people said, oh, it was a dummy, it was part of a Hollywood prop. What's your opinion of this alien autopsy that went viral?
I was in the first show that was done by Fox Network. I met twice with Mr. Ray Santilli in England, mm-hmm. who owned the rights to that. Everything he told me in our first conversation by phone was a lie. And it wasn't any better when I got there. So I was not impressed, and I think it was a phony, well, a hoax, call it what you want, I guess. I'm not saying autopsies haven't been done of aliens. Of course they have. But that one isn't genuine. And his story, I mean, I even found pictures of the guy he says was the photographer. He had died years before Ray said he met with him. I even had one time had the name of the rabbi who took care of his funeral. I mean, it didn't stand up, and it was a darn shame. They even told me, and Ray told me the first time around, that, President Truman was in the movie, which is baloney, and he changed the place from Roswell to Socorro, or as he pronounced it, Socorro. I mean, It was a sad tale, and I talked to people who were at the initial press conference, and no way, Jose, sorry.
Well, can you tell us a little bit, just one more question I'd like to ask you, about this Betty and Barney Hill UFO experience, because it really hasn't got the mainstream press that Roswell has got, but it stands on its own ground, too, as well.
Well, yeah. I mean, the first book, The Interrupted Journey by John Fuller, was a bestseller. That was back in the mid-60s. The event took place in 61. And there's a new book that came out in 2007 that I was co-author of, Captured the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience. My co-author, Kathleen Martin, is Betty's niece. Had all the tapes, the hypnosis tapes, and all the rest. She did most of the work on the book, but they put my name first, and I complained. They said, Stan, it'll sell more. What do you say to that? So, and Kathy will be making a presentation about the Hill case in Roswell next week. And as a matter of fact, kind of intriguing, there was a movie done in 1975 with James Earl Jones playing Barney and Estelle Parsons playing Betty. NBC, Universal Studios. They came to me as a consultant. I was living in Southern California. They got my name from the Air Force, believe it or not, which I think is hilarious. But movie rights have just been optioned for Captured. Along, and even before that, the rights to my book, Top Secret Magic, M-A-J-I-C, about the Majestic 12 documents, was optioned, and the screenplay has been written for that. And the movie would be Magic Men. You know anybody who wants to spend a few million dollars, make a movie? Come on. And so I've got the possibility of two different books being made into movies, hopefully while I'm still alive.
Good stuff.
So, you know, Bryce Stable is doing this, Stellar Productions, and some of you may remember the Dark Skies television series, mm-hmm. that cover-up and stuff. So he did that. He's very knowledgeable. He's also co-author of a book, After Disclosure. So, you know, these are exciting times. But the Hill case, yes. And there's a lot of stuff in our book that isn't in any other book. The star map work, the comparative analysis that Kathleen did of, okay, here's what Barney said under hypnosis, here's what Betty said. Do they match when they were together? Here's Betty's dreams, which some people want to blame it all on that. Doesn't match what came out under hypnosis. So, very clear-cut indication of truth coming out. And as a matter of fact, last year they had the 50th anniversary celebration in Indian Head in New Hampshire in mid-September. And it's going to be another one this year. Kathleen and I were both there. There was a tour, showed you where things happened. It's in New Hampshire, not too far from you guys. And there will be another one, I think it's the 14th, 15th, 16th of September. These are all listed on the website, www.stantonfriedman.com.
Yes, and we have put up a live link to that
website.
You know, where we have our upcoming events page with, you know, the event, of course, at the CNE coming up, and, of course, with a direct link to Stan's website. So you can, you know, peruse his books and DVDs and, you know, take a taste of something firsthand if you wish, because, you know, you have to support the people who do a lot of work for the world and for alternative media, for alternative thought. And this isn't a place where you check your brain at the door. We encourage people to do their own research and to think for themselves. And, you know, you just can't go wrong picking up almost any topic, you know, that is avant-garde, because mainstream media is just nothing more than a box to put your brain in and have it sleep. When we were doing this question about the autopsies, did you ever have any connection with the mortician or know anything about Glenn Dennis, the chaplain?
I was the first one that Glenn talked to, as a matter of fact. I had gotten his name from somebody, as somebody who might know something. I called him, and he was very close-mouthed. But I said, look, why don't I send you some background information, and you can decide whether you want to talk to me or not. And so I did that, and then I was going down there to be in a television program, Unsolved Mysteries. And I contacted Glenn, and he had liked what I had sent him. And he was at the old historic Wortley Hotel in the place where all kinds of Western stuff took place, big celebration. Why don't you come out and we'll talk to you? And one of his friends drove me out, and he's running the dining room at the hotel, and I'm recording, and there's mariachi music in the background, and he's telling me how he was called by people at the base. His company, Ballard Funeral Home, had the contract. There were thousands of people working out there, and some of them died, obviously, and had the contract to supply funeral services and stuff. And he gets a call asking about child-sized caskets. And what would you do to preserve a body that had been out in the heat? And he mentioned dry ice. It gets pretty hot in Roswell. I'm anticipating 105 next week. So bodies or anything lying out in the desert for a while, as you said earlier, are going to smell pretty bad and not be preserved very well and so forth. And so he went to the base. I mean, that was one set of things. He got called, asked for information. He knew where he could get small caskets. And then an airman had an accident, and the Ballard Funeral Home had the contract for ambulance services. That was not uncommon back then. I mean, a hearse makes a good ambulance when you think about it. So he takes the airman out to the base, takes him around to the base hospital, goes inside, and then sees a nurse that he knows. And she said, "What are you doing here? Get out of here." And he doesn't know what's going on. And an officer comes and threatens him. And, you'll be picking your teeth out of the desert. Don't you say anything. He doesn't know what they're talking about. Anyway, he goes to lunch at the officer's club the next day with this nurse. And she tells him that she was grabbed by a couple of doctors to help with an autopsy of an alien. She didn't use the term alien. A very strange, smelly body. And she drew a drawing of what the body looked like. And Glenn had been threatened not to say anything. And when he went to talk to her again, she was gone, been sent off. And so I was the first one he talked to, and because I was down there to give a lecture out at White Sands Missile Range, as a matter of fact. And Glenn is... he's still alive, but he's got advanced Alzheimer's, and hasn't done any interviews for years.
Well, how long after the event was it that you spoke to him?
Well, I spoke to him, it was probably 79, boys on some history, in the 80s. Didn't talk to anybody until, when I heard Jesse Marcel's story, well, what do I do? He doesn't have a specific date. I hear a second story about that other crash up in Bemidji, Minnesota. I shared it with Bill Moore. He had a third story about an English actor driving across from Los Angeles to Philadelphia who heard a story about a crash saucer in New Mexico. And that one, he could pin down the date because it wasn't a trip you made very often back then. And Bill went to the University of Minnesota Library, we talked about this in Minnesota, and found the story. And it verified what Jesse had told me, what the other guy had told me. The next year and a half, we found 62 people connected with the case. And I'll admit, there was a little luck. I looked at an editor and publisher, found if there was a newspaper in Roswell. What did I know about Roswell? And there was, so I called, asked for the editor from 47. This is in 78. Well, he's long gone. What do you need? And I mentioned, I've got a newspaper article here. It says the base public information officer, a guy named Hout, his name is spelled four different ways. Before I could finish the sentence, she says, "Oh, his wife works here." What? You know, how lucky can you get? He was from Chicago, but he managed to stay in Roswell. Loves it. Loved it. He's dead now. And his daughter, as a matter of fact, runs the museum down there. But Walter was a great help. He was not just a PR guy. He flew more than 20 missions as a bombardier over Japan. He was such a good one that he dropped the instrument package on one of the nuclear weapons tested in 1946 in the Pacific. And Walter had a base yearbook. Was a big help. He remembered Jesse Marcel. And very well liked in town. I do a lot of sort of quiet checking on people. Because in small towns, you know whether a guy's a fraud or not. You know what I mean? You don't get by. being a liar and a storyteller and so forth. And Walter was extremely well thought of. So, yeah, he may have been the, he probably wasn't one who mentioned Glenn Dennis. They knew each other, of course. And so it's been a long trek. A lot of phony stories along the way. Some very good people. Dr. Marcel, for example. I really got angry when Peter Jennings' people interviewed him for their mockumentary in 2005. I mean, it was bad enough they spent an hour with me and used 20 seconds and called me a promoter twice. But they interviewed Dr. Marcel, who was on leave from being called back in at age 68 to serve in the military. He was on leave from Iraq, where he flew 225 combat hours as a flight surgeon and helicopter pilot. And they talked to him. They never mentioned that he was a medical doctor, a colonel, a combat pilot. I think those go to credibility, don't you?
Absolutely.
That's why we're here.
Credibility.
They don't do the job, and they actually destroy, you know, almost any semblance of free speech or, you know, independent thought. And that's one of my big, you know, pushes to do an alternative media show is the power is in the hands of the listener, the viewer. You change the channel, you change the outcome of the world. And
yeah,
if you just fall into this little niche that they want to make for you, basically you're just existing in an intellectual straitjacket. And, you know, once you hear copious amounts of truths, it becomes very difficult to listen to these spin doctors anymore. It's just, I have to turn them
you
off.
You noticed that, huh?
Yeah.
And a lot of the fans that follow this show are very astute in pointing that out in no uncertain terms. Like, there's just not a whole lot out there to really listen to and sink your teeth into because we don't mask anything or hide anything. We just, you know, go for the jugular vein and let the chips fall where they may. And people appreciate that because, you know, the lies, you know, how do you know that they're lying to us? Well, one of the big events is, you know, the extent they went to get the few samples that people took into their homes. Like, you know, the military, the law enforcement authorities went to people's homes and ripping up floorboards, you know,
yep,
breaking into every little dark cranny and crook in your home to get a piece of a balloon. Like, that you could buy at the surplus store. So tell me that, you know, you can see by the reaction that you've caused what the truth is. The reaction was they overreacted by a factor of a million if this was really a balloon. So
yes,
it can't be a balloon. It has to be an unidentified flying object, a flying saucer, something of high integrated technology that, you know, whether... I don't think there's anything in the Skunk Works that they could have come up with at the time.
No.
As you described the bits and pieces on the ground, you're looking at technology that is just so far advanced that even today we'd be scratching our head for answers.
Well, you know, let me give you an example. When I mentioned before about duplicating alien technology, if you'd given the smartest people on the planet a cheap wristwatch, a digital wristwatch from today, back in 1935, they would have known it was a watch and there'd be a battery in it. They could not have analyzed the chip, and they certainly couldn't have duplicated it. When Intel builds a chip factory, it's $1 billion. And so the analytical techniques, people say, do you think they still have the records? I say, sure. You go back to it once your techniques get better, and you'll learn more. That's the way of science. You know, tenths of a percent in composition, and then hundredths of a percent, thousands of a percent, and then it's parts per million. That tells you a wholly different story.
Where would you think aliens would most potentially be coming from? You know, what star system do you think would be the most logical source?
Certainly the star map from the Betty and Barney Hill case gives us a really a number one target. The Marjorie Fish built 27 different three-dimensional models of our local galactic neighborhood, trying to match the drawing made by Betty Hill under hypnosis of what she saw when she asked the leader of the crew on board the craft where they were from. He showed her a three-dimensional model, and she says, where are you on the map? And wise guy alien, he asked her, do you know where you are on the map? No, I don't know anything about astronomy. How can I tell you where I'm from if you don't know where you're at? End of discussion. But Marjorie, who was a brilliant woman, I was the first to publish about her work, so I can say that I did meet with her more than once, was able to do a tremendous amount of work. It's described and captured. The base stars, two stars close together in the model, Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 Reticuli, that's the constellation of Reticulum, which you can't see from here. That means the net in Latin. You have to go below the equator to see them. Now, these two stars just happen to be the closest to each other pair of sun-like stars in our entire local neighborhood. They're only 39.3 light years from here. That's just down the street. The galaxy is about 100,000 light years across. And these two from each other are about an eighth of a light year apart. So they are 30 times closer to each other, each visible from a planet around the other all day long. 30 times closer to each other than the sun is to the next star over. We're out in the boonies. And, oh, by the way, they just happen to be a cool billion years older than the sun. So you had two reasons to think they worked on interstellar travel before we did. They had a heck of a lot of time to do it, and they had far more incentive. When you got a next-door neighbor, you have more incentive. So now, with the Kepler spacecraft, you know, man's attitude about his importance keeps going down, doesn't it? Remember, there was a day when the Earth was the center of the universe, right?
Exactly.
We all know that. Oh, no, it isn't. But the Kepler space satellite is finding planets all over the place out there. And the best estimates today were Frank Drake of the SETI movement had guessed that maybe as many as 10,000 stars having planets from which a signal could be sent. He never has answered the question, why in the heck would anybody in his right mind send a signal to Earth using technology appropriate to our primitive radio technology? No insult meant, guys. You know, we've only had the long-distance radio since 1901 with Marconi. Those two stars make the ideal target as far as I'm concerned. And Kepler says there are stars all over the place and planets all over the place. And anybody who thinks we're at the top of the heap, you know, what kind of technology do we have 200 years ago, no less 2,000 years ago, no less a billion years ago? And anybody who doesn't think our technology moves rapidly is wrong. My mantra is that technological progress comes from doing things differently in an unpredictable way. The future is not an extrapolation of the past. A laser isn't just a better light bulb, in other words. Entirely different physics. And fission and fusion are not just better chemical processes. Entirely different. So I would expect that to be sort of the headquarters of the local galactic neighborhood. And, you know, what's funny is, if we could build Kepler now, it went up, 3 years ago, surely other civilizations had their Keplers a million years ago. They know where everybody is.
Mm.
And that's the thing, that we can't get past that fact that, oh, we don't know everything, and little we do know, we haven't known for very long. And people say, why would anybody come here, Stan? You know, landing on the White House lawn is the ideal notion. I try to point out, if you look around the planet, the primary motivation seems to be survival and security. Isn't everybody concerned about those things? If you're not, you don't survive. That means you have to keep tabs on the primitives in the neighborhood, but only close tabs on those primitives who show that they might be able to bother you. At the end of World War II, there were three signs that these idiot Earthlings just killed 60 million of their own kind, destroyed 1,700 cities, would soon be able to move out, soon meaning 100 years, which is nothing on a cosmic timescale. The three signs were very straightforward. Nuclear weapons, powerful rockets. The Germans were firing some good rockets at England. And radar, which was the beginning of the electronics era. There was no radar before World War II in Europe. Isn't it amazing? The only place in the world in July 1947 where you could check on all three of these was southeastern New Mexico. That's where the first nuclear bomb was tested at Trinity Site. I was there in April. It's only open 2 days a year. I took a tour of people, and as you'll find from my website, I'll be taking another tour there in October, the other day, the first Saturday in October. And White Sands Missile Range, where we were firing all the captured German V-2s.
As you all know, everything begins with an idea. Ideas have helped shape the very world we live in. ThePowerMall.com began as an idea, allowing entrepreneurs and small business owners like yourself the opportunity to not only survive, but thrive in an era where corporations dominate. ThePowerMall.com is a small family-owned business who has partnered with companies you've come to rely on and trust over the years, like Strauss Heart Drops, North American Urban Spice, Miracle 2 Soaps, Vitamir, Numana Foods, Storage, to name just a few. Fight back against large corporations when you buy from thepowermall.com. Need to speak to a real person? Call Jay at thepowermall.com and receive superior customer service. Call 1-877-817-9829 right now. That number again is 1-877-817-9829. Support small businesses and buy from the good guys at thepowermall.com. That's thepowermall.com.
Dr. Joe Schneller.
The efficacy that we're looking for, that we're going to prove, is that Carnivora wakes up this immune system and makes it dominant.
I highly recommend that you get started right away using Carnivora because it really will help you. Just follow the directions as the company gives them to you. And I just want everybody to know that there's been no one paid to do this. I'm doing this on my own because I care about everybody and want to see healthy people.
My husband has recovered tremendously after the physician suggested that he start taking Carnivora. When he was doing so well, I decided to start taking it as well, and we're both so pleased to be able to feel healthy again.
Hello, folks. Richard Ostro of Carnivora Research International here. Visit CARNIVORA.com or call 1-866-VENUS-FLY. That's carnivora.com or 1-866-VENUS-FLY. Call us today.